Chapter 5, An Awakened Sense of Divine Destiny. We must make this distinction. A pastor asks, "I am perplexed. I plead and pour out my heart to this congregation. Why? Why do they manifest such indifference towards really fulfilling God's purpose and calling?" In hearing him, one has answered, "It is true that in every breast there is a sense of destiny. In some it is more intense than in others, but this is very different from the sense of divine destiny consciousness. The first is naturally built into every man, where the latter comes only by divine awakening and impartation. It is much more than being born again, more than an experience of sanctification or filling of the Spirit. Many who can testify to such experiences still seem to lack this special awakening which tunes the heart strings with the eternal strings of God's own heart, thus making one spoiled for anything that is not wholly aligned with his eternal purpose. As we shall point out in this chapter, we are sure there will be no real moving unto full stature until God has sensitized our inner compass to help us wholly follow his purpose and calling. Indeed, here is an imperative need. What is more tragic than to see individuals who are placed here by God to fulfill some unique and glorious destiny, still wandering aimlessly with no awakened sense of divine purpose or calling? Thousands who sit in church pews week after week have somehow missed that one basic ingredient which alone can give meaning, direction, purpose, and dedication to life: the sense of divine destiny. Man was designed as the masterpiece of creation, and as one of his greatest gifts from God, he was given a built-in mechanism which works much like a compass. This inner compass is an inner sense of consciousness placed in every man by God that he might forever have some means to tug upon the man of his creation, no matter how indifferent or unresponsive he might become toward God. To better understand just how this inner compass works, suppose we visit a plant where mariners' compasses are being manufactured. The needles of the compasses would point in every direction if they were not magnetized. In this process of being magnetized, each needle receives a peculiar power. From that moment on, it points only to the north and is constant and true forever. The compass needle can now be depended upon. It is predictable. It no longer points toward every object on the horizon. All of the heavenly bodies try to attract it. The sun may dazzle it, meteors may beckon it, stars may twinkle at it as though trying to win its affection. But the magnetized needle remains true to its objective. With a finger that never errs in sunshine or in storm, it points constantly toward its star. Consider what God did in the first morning of creation when he magnetized every needle, atoms, and every man in Adam, magnetized them with the eternal purpose that they were created to serve. Yet we know all too well how the enemy slipped into the garden and the needle was deflected toward other purposes. Now the needle, even though it still has its original pole, seems mostly unpredictable. For the most part, it seems almost to have lost its sense of destiny and direction. Like an erratic compass, it seems pulled by whatever is closest to it. Yet in those precarious hours when one is left all alone, in those fleeting seconds when life seems almost to ebb away, the needle somehow flicks back to its true north, as though to remind each one just how far he has missed or just how little he has fulfilled the divine purpose for which he was once magnetized by God. It is indeed a crisis hour when God awakens man and he by his own choice wholly gives himself for a new spiritual magnetizing and synchronizing to fulfill God's eternal purpose. Suddenly life takes on new meaning. He realizes that the most important thing about anything is its purpose, and it is with purpose we must always begin. Understanding purpose gives full meaning to everything. Look around you in the room where you sit. Consider every object that comes before your eye. The chairs, the table, the lamp, the rug. What is the most significant thing about each of these? It is not the size, the color, the nature, or the quality, though these may seem to be important. The primary thing about any of these is its purpose. If a chair will not hold one up as he sits on it, the size, the color, and the quality really do not matter. If the table does not fulfill its purpose as a table, everything else about that table, which seems important, becomes unimportant. Its design, style, finish, or condition has little significance if it will not hold a lamp, books, or the family dinner. Just think, then, what happens when one's life is magnetized by ultimate direction and eternal purpose? When our long-term objectives are accurately focused and fully supported by our physical industry and spiritual powers, then size, quality, condition, nothing of lesser importance can pull our needle. When one's life is really dedicated to its mission, then distractions lose their power. No moon that shines with borrowed light or meteors that dazzle but never guide can turn the needle of one's purpose from God's ultimate north. It is perfectly astounding how undreamed of mental and spiritual faculties rush to our assistance when once we have committed our whole soul to one unwavering aim. Life may be long or filled with breath, but it becomes monotonous if it is meaningless and unmagnetized. It is not monotonous, however, if it is truly gripped by divine purpose. We must see, then, how these following three things are so important in our moving toward full stature of purpose. We must discover why goals are imperative, why some goals have no drawing power, and how to keep all immediate goals in line with the ultimate goal. Now, by way of contrast, think of a human personality, as we so often see around us, lacking in definite focus and in the supporting energy of accomplishment. When some little problem develops, magnetism loses its charge and permits the compass needle to jump around and divert to another attraction. If any one of 1,000 little upsets come along, this needle deserts its star to follow whatever new interest is knocking at its door. Thus, when there is no focused goal or gripping overall purpose, people generally concentrate on motion. Instead of working toward an ideal, they keep changing the ideal and calling it progress. They do not know where they are going, but they are certainly on their way. They are so much like a sculptor who, after hacking and cutting away at a block of marble all day, was asked, "What are you making?" He said, "I really don't know. I have not seen the plan." No wonder he was bored, frustrated, and the day was filled with emptiness. Many people live 10, 20, 30, and 50 years without an overmastering purpose. No wonder they find their existence humdrum and tiresome. If they were farmers, they would probably plant wheat one week, root it up, plant barley the next, then dig up the barley and plant watermelon, then dig up the watermelon another week and plant oats. Fall comes around and they have no harvest. If they repeated this process year after year, wouldn't they be considered insane? Yet it is this very meaninglessness of life that produces our present neurosis, even in the lives of believers who are governed by an escape philosophy instead of being dedicated to a life of divine fulfillment. All around us, mass boredom is leading to revolution. A boy is given a BB gun. If the father gives him a target, a bullseye on the side of a barn or even an old tin can, the boy is happy to use the gun as it ought to be used. Yet if no target is given, or if it is ignored, the lad soon begins shooting at anything, particularly school windows. The revolutionary spirit in the world today is not confined to the underprivileged nations seeking independence, to the colored folk demanding their rights, or to juvenile delinquents without direction or purpose. It is running like a deep undercurrent through all the churches, fundamental and otherwise. This revolutionary spirit is born of purposeless and meaningless existence. Lawlessness lays hold of those who are not properly occupied. I like this homely bit of proof. A university kept dogs for experimental purposes in two separate cages. In one cage were dogs without fleas. In the other cage were dogs with fleas, waiting to be dipped and defleed. The professor noted the later dogs had something to keep them busy. The other dogs howled and barked and, in general, created many problems of canine delinquency. The scientists concluded that animals are made to expend purposeful energy. The restlessness of the flea-less dogs was a kind of regulatory mechanism for keeping the organism fit. In the higher realm, man's powers are directed to the expenditure of energy for an overall purpose. If he lacks purpose, giddiness, restlessness, and consequent boredom are the price he has to pay. The most bored people in life are not the underprivileged, but the overprivileged. The moral is not to have fleas, annoyances, or problems. The moral is to have something to live for, not for just today and tomorrow, but always. Man is so constituted that he must not only have goals, but goals that are imperative and worthy of his being as a man. What then is the reason some goals have no drawing power? What we are in our inner being determines what we live for and are responsive to. Until our appetite is changed, our desires and goals will not change. It is not new goals, but a new nature that we need. In explaining the low state of affairs among even the evangelical wing of the church, the late A.W. Tozer cried out against changing our religious menus when we should be changing our appetites. He explained the obvious boredom in church like this. Boredom comes when a man must try to hear with relish what for want of relish he hardly hears at all. By this definition, there is certainly much boredom in religion these days. The businessman on a Sunday morning whose mind is on golf can scarcely distinguish his lack of interest in the sermon he is compelled to hear. The housewife who is unacquainted with the learned theological or philosophical jargon of the speaker, the young couple who feel a tingle of love for each other, but who neither love nor know the one about whom the choir is singing, these cannot escape the low-grade mental pain we call boredom while they struggle to keep their attention focused upon the service. All these are too courteous to admit to others that they are bored, and possibly too timid to admit it even to themselves. But I believe that a bit of candid confession would do us all good. But why all this emptiness and artificiality? It is simply that we have tried to change our minds without having a change of heart or nature. The New Testament standard of conversion demands regeneration, and this we largely missed in our man-centered appeal for decisions. It is true the religious vocabulary is used, but one essential has been bypassed. God cannot change the heart and nature where there has been no governmental change, no turning from our own lordship to his lordship. With a true change of government comes a change of purpose and appetite. Instead of seeking to use God for one's own purpose, this means giving one's being to him for his purpose. In this crisis of giving ourselves unto him, God begins the impartation of his own divine nature, and our responses change accordingly. As long as man still desires things, he cannot be satisfied with just God. Was it not so with Abram? God had first offered to give him Canaan land, to make him a great nation, to bless him and make his name great. How responsive was Abram to all this? He forsook his homeland and in due time left his father. But it was not until Abraham had deliberately refused to take the spoil of battle that God could move in to announce to him, "Abram, I am thy exceeding great reward." Genesis 15:1. Here is our lesson. Until God changed Abram's inner desire and helped him to say, "I will not take anything lest thou shouldst say, I have made Abram rich," what would it have meant to him to offer himself as an exceeding great reward? God's way, then, is to change our inner being, to make us partakers of the divine nature, so we will have an appetite for spiritual things. God does not change goals to fit our appetite, but works upon our inner being that we might truly come to have hunger for God, for himself. Until that inner change has been wrought, all religious life is completely exteriorized. Those who have no longing for God himself become preoccupied with things and events, nor can they understand or appreciate the songwriter's depth of meaning in the following lines. "My goal is God himself, not joy or peace, not even blessing, but himself, my God." It appears, then, there are two reasons some goals seem to have no drawing power. What we are determines what we enjoy. God's goal can have no real appeal to us until we are in harmony with his nature and being. Our perverted nature must be exchanged for his divine nature before we can find his goal fully satisfying. Furthermore, man is designed in his inner being for that which is ultimate. Any lesser goal will only partially or temporarily satisfy. Man is made for an increasing measure of satisfaction. The inner gnawing will continue until he is fully prepared for that which is ultimate.